Now, Mr. Breck, would you tell the committee whether or not one of the characters in this play was murdered by his comrades because it was in the best interest of the party? Is that true, of the Communist Party?
No, it is not not quite.
Because so he violated discipline, he was murdered by his comrades. Isn't that true?
No, that is not not really so in the play. You will find when you read it carefully that, like in the old Japanese play, where other ideas were at stake, the young man who died was convinced that he had done damage to the mission he believed in, and he agreed to that and was ready to die in order not to make greater that damage. So he asks his comrades to help him, and all of them together help him to die. He jumps into a abyss, and they lead him tenderly to that abyss, and that's the story.
Well, I gather from your remarks, from your answer, that he was just killed, he wasn't murdered.
He wanted to die.
So they killed him?
No, they did not kill him, not in this story. He killed himself, they supported him. But, of course, they had told him it were better when he disappeared. Oh. for him and them and the cause he also believed in up till the end.
Brecht would seem to be speaking here not of the measures taken, but of Der Ja-Sager, He Who Says Yes, another play of his that is derived from the same no play as The Measures Taken. No one will ever know whether Brecht's memory was playing him tricks or whether he wanted to lead Mr. Thomas a dance.
Mr. Brecht, could you tell the committee how many times you've been to Moscow?
Yeah. I was invited to Moscow two times.
Who invited you?
The first time I was invited by Vox, that is an organization for cultural exchange. I was invited to show a documentary picture I had helped to make in Berlin.
What was the name of that picture?
The name is the name of a suburb of Berlin, Hule Wampe.
The picture was shown in the United States under the title Whither Germany. Ernst Busch was a leading actor in it, and it had a score by Hans Eisler. The Brecht-Eisler solidarity song, to be mentioned shortly by Stripling, was sung in the picture.
K-U-H-L-E-W-A-M-P-E.
While you were in Berlin, did you meet, while in Moscow, did you meet Sergei T-R-E-T-Y-A-K-O-V? T-R-E-T-Y-A-K-O-V. Tretiakov,
that is a Russian playwright, yes.
Writer.
Yes.
Sergei Tretiakov was indeed a Russian playwright and quite a famous one. He wrote Roar China, which the Theatre Guild produced in New York in 1930. It is ironical that the article cited by Stripling appeared in a Moscow magazine as late as 1937, since soon after that Stalin purged Tretiakov as a Trotskyite. Brecht, though he is speaking 10 years later, probably did not know how and why Tretyakov died.
He translated some of my poems and I think one play.
Mr. Chairman, International Literature, number 5, 1937, published by the State Literary Art Publishing House in Moscow, had an article by Sergei Tretyakov, leading Soviet writer, an interview he had with Mr. Brecht. On page 60, it states, quote, I was a member of the, this is, he's quoting Mr. Brecht, I was a member of the Augsburg Revolutionary Committee, Brecht continued. Nearby in Munich, Levine raised the banner of Soviet power. Augsburg lived in the reflected glow of Munich. The hospital was the only militant unit in the town. It elected me to the Revolutionary Committee, end quote. Tretyakov continues. He wrote Drum at Night. This work contained echoes of the revolution. The work was a scathing satire on those who had deserted the revolution. His play, Das Nominee, the first of Brecht's plays on a communist theme, is arranged like a court where the characters try to justify themselves for having killed a comrade. When he visited Moscow in 1932, Brecht told me his plan to organize a theater in Berlin which would reenact the most interesting court trials in the history of mankind. For example, the trial of Karl Marx. The story of economics brought Brecht to Marx and Lenin, whose works became an indispensable part of his library. Brecht studies and quotes Lenin. Lenin is a great thinker and is a great master of prose. According to Brecht, the theater should act upon the spectator's intellect. The traditional drama portrays the struggle of class instincts. Brecht demands that the struggle of class instincts be replaced by the struggle of social consciousness, of social conviction. He maintains that the situation must not only be felt, but explained, crystallized into the idea which will overturn the world. Brecht, the artist, has an extremely broad and varied range. He has composed many ballads, songs, and choruses on the subject of revolutionary ruthlessness. His bookshelf, however, contains books of science and action and Lenin. Do you recall that interview, Mr. Brecht?
No. Must have been written 20 years ago or so. I don't know. See.
I'll show you the magazine, Mr. Brecht.
Yeah. I do not doubt there was also said interview, of course. I do not recall, Mr. Stribling, I do not recall the interview in itself. I think it is a more or less journalistic zusammenfassung.
Summary, make up.
A summary of talks or discussions about many things made by Tretyakov.
Brecht was right, and Stripling omitted to say that this was all explained in the article itself. Stripling also did not bother to explain that he did not read straight on in the article, but made many omissions ad lib.
Have many of your writings been based upon the philosophy of Lenin? Marx?
No, I don't think that is quite correct. And but, of course, I studied, I had to study as a playwright, I think, who wrote historical plays. I, of course, had to study Marx's ideas about history. I do not think that intelligent plays today can be written without that study. Also, history now is written now is widely influenced by the studies of Marx about history.
Mr. Brecht, since you have been in the United States, have you attended any Communist Party meetings?
No, I do not think so.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, aren't you certain?
No. I'm certain, I think.
You're
yes.
Certain that you've never attended?
Yeah. quite, I think so.
You see,
I'm here 6 years. I'm here 6 years. I do not think so. They do not think that I attended political meetings.
No, never mind political meeting, but have you attended any communist meetings in the United States?
I do not think so. No.
You're certain?
I think I'm certain.
You think you're certain?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know what I wanted to put
it. No, I have not attended such meetings, in my opinion.
Mr. Breck, have you, since you've been in the United States, have you met with any officials of the Soviet government?
Yes, in Hollywood, I was invited sometimes, 3 or 4 times, to the Soviet consulate, with many others.
What others?
What
others?
With other writers and artists and actors. They gave some receptions at the special Soviet fire
festivities.
Yeah, festivities.
Did any officials of the Soviet government ever come and visit you?
I don't think so.
Didn't Gregory Kaifetz visit you on April the 14th, 1943? Vice Consulate, the Soviet government. You know Gregory Kaifetz, don't you?
Watch out on this one.
I don't remember that name, but I might have known him, yes.
Gregory Kaifetz was a Soviet vice consul in San Francisco. Hans Eisler seems to have been questioned about him by a subcommittee of the HUAC that went out to California in the spring of 47. Later on the same day as Bertolt Brecht appeared in Washington, a committee investigator, Louis J. Russell, would claim to have linked Gregory Kaifetz, through intermediaries, to J. Robert Oppenheimer. One could say with some reason that the whole Oppenheimer case dates from here.
I don't remember.
Did he come and visit you on April the 14th? 1943.
It is quite possible.
And again on April the 27th. And again on June 16, 1944.
That is quite possible, yes. That somebody, I do not know, I do not remember the name, but that somebody of the cultural attachés or was
cultural attachés.
Yeah,
spell the name.
Vice consul.
Gregori, capital Kheifets. I'll spell the last name again. Kheifets.
Kaifetz.
Yes. Do you remember Mr. Kaifetz?
I do not remember the name, but it is quite possible. But I remember from the Russian consulate, some people visited me. Not only this man, also I think consul once, but I do not remember his name either.
What was the nature of his business?
It must have been my literary connections with German writers, and some of them are friends of mine.
German writers?
In Moscow.
In Moscow.
Yeah. And there appeared in the Staatsverlag in Soviet Union translations of my plays, for instance. This Private Life of the Master Race and Galileo, and a novel, The Penny for the Poor, and poems and so.
Did Gerhard Eisler ever visit you? Not Hans, but Gerhard.
Yeah, I met Gerhard Eisler too. He's the brother of Hans, and he visited me with hands and then three or four times without hands.
Could you tell us in what year he visited you? Wasn't it the same year that Mr. Kaifitz visited you?
I do not know, but there's no connection.
Do you recall him visiting you on January the 17th, 1944?
No, I do not recall his date. But he might have visited me in this state.
Where did he visit you?
Now, he used to ask for his brother, who, as I told you, is an old friend of mine, and we played some games of chess too, and we spoke about politics.
About politics?
Yeah.
He's what was that last answer? I didn't get the last answer.
They spoke about politics. In any of your conversations with Gerhard Eisler, did you discuss the German communist movement in Germany?
We spoke about, of course, about German politics. He's a specialist in that. He's a politician.
He is a politician.
So he knew very much more than I knew about the situation in Germany.
Mr. Brecht, can you tell the committee, when you entered this country, did you make a statement to the Immigration Service concerning your past affiliations?
I do not remember to have made such a statement, but I made, I think, the usual statement that I did not want or intend to overthrow the American government. I might have been asked whether I belonged to the Communist Party. I do not remember to have been asked, but then I would have answered what I told you, that I was not. That's what I remember.
You stated, did they ask you whether or not you'd ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I do not remember.
Did they ask you whether or not you'd ever been to the Soviet Union?
I think they asked me yes, and I told them.
Did they question you about your writings?
No, not as I remember, no. No, they did not. I do not remember any discussion about literature in the consulate in Helsinki.
Now, you stated that you sold the book, the story, Hangman Also Died, to United Artists. Is that correct?
To an independent firm in.
Did Hans Eisler do the background music for Hangman Also Died?
Yes, he did.
Do you recall who starred in that picture?
No, I do not.
You don't even remember who played the leading role in the picture?
I think Brian Dunleavy did it.
Do you remember any of the other actors or actresses who were in it?
No, I do not. You see, it had not very much to do with the filmization itself. I saw the story and I gave then to the script writers some advice about the background of Nazism in Czechoslovakia. So, had nothing to do with the actor.
Ms. Tripling, can we hurry this along? We've got a heavy schedule.
Yes. Now, Mr. Brecht, since you have been in the United States, have you contributed articles to any communist publications in the United States?
I don't think so, no.
Are you familiar with the magazine New Masses?
No.
You never heard of it?
Yes, of course.
Did you ever contribute anything to it?
No.
Did they ever publish any of your works?
That I do not know. They might have published some translation of a poem, I think. But I had no direct connections. Nor did I send them anything.
I believe that Brecht's answer is truthful. Searching the New Masses files does not turn up anything by him. It seems that he sent the New Masses a letter in 1935 protesting against the theatre union's production of his play The Mother, but that the New Masses never printed the letter. In Praise of Learning, which Mr. Stripling is about to mention, is a song from the mother, and it was often sung by itself, as, for example, on an American phonograph record of the 30s, issued under the label Timely Recording Company, sung by the new singers with Mark Blitzstein at the piano. The line which will be debated reads in German, Du musst die Führung übernehmen, which means you must take over the leadership. The translation which Brecht is about to object to is actually rather close to the original.
Did you collaborate with Hans Eisler in song In Praise of Learning?
Yeah, I collaborated. I wrote that song. He only wrote the
music. You wrote the song?
I wrote the song.
Would you recite to the committee the words of that song?
Yeah, I would. May I point out that song comes from an adaptation I made of Gorky's novel The Mother. And in this song, a Russian worker woman addresses other poor people.
It was produced in this country, was it?
Yes. Certified in New York.
Yes. Now, I'll read the words and ask you if this is true.
Please.
Learn now the simple truth. You for whom the time has come at last. It is not too late. Learn now the ABC. It is not enough, but learn it still. Fear not. Be not downhearted. Begin. You must learn the lesson. You must be ready to take over.
Excuse me. That is the wrong translation. That is not right. Just 1 second. I'll give you the correct text.
That's not a correct translation?
It's not correct, no. As to the meaning, it is not correct. As to the meaning, it is not very beautiful, but I'm not speaking
about
that.
What does it mean?
No.
Well, here is the... Songs of the People, which was issued by the Communist Party of the United States, published by the Workers' Library of Publishers. Page 24, it says, In Praise of Learning, by Bert Brecht, music by Hans Eisler. And it says here, you must be ready to take over. Learn it, men on the dole. Learn it, men in the prisons. Learn it, women in the kitchen. Learn it, men of 65. You must be ready to take over.
Here,
and,
where...
goes right on through. That's the chorus of it. You must be ready to take over.
Mr. Stripling, maybe the translator...
The correct translation would be, you must take the lead.
You must take the lead.
The lead. He definitely says lead. It's the same word as the leader Hitler or something like that. The translation is not a literary translation of the German text I see here.
Well, Mr. Brecht, as it has been published in these publications of the Communist Party, then, is that incorrect? What did you mean?
I do not remember to have... I never got that book myself. I must not have been in the country when it was published. I think it was published as a song of... one of the songs Eisler had written the music to. I did not give any permission to publish it. I did not see... I think I never saw the translation.
Well, do you have the words there before
in
you?
German, yes.
Of the song, as it appears?
Oh, yes, in the book.
Not as it was originally
in German day.
It goes on. You must be ready to take over. You must be ready to take over. Don't hesitate to ask questions, comrade. Is that in there? Don't hesitate to ask questions, comrade.
Why not let him translate from the German word for word?
Think you are mainly interested in translation of this refrain, which comes back and back, which is the end.
I can't understand the interpreter any more than I can understand.
Mr. Sherman, I apologize. I said, Sherman,
if you just please speak in that microphone, maybe we can make out.
The last line of all three verses is correctly to be translated, you must take over the lead, and not you must take over. You must take the lead would be the best and correct, most accurate translation.
Mr. Breck, did you ever make application to join the Communist Party?
I do not understand the question. Did I make...
Have you ever made application to join the Communist Party of any
no,
country?
No. Never.
Mr. Chairman, we have...
I was an independent rider, and I wanted to be an independent rider, and I pointed that out. And also, theoretically, I think it was the best for me not to join any party, whatever. And all these things you read here were not only written for the German communists, but they were also written for the for workers of any other kind. Social democratic workers were in this performances, so were Catholic workers from Catholic unions, so were workers which never had been in a party or didn't want to go into a party.
Mr. Breck, did Gerhard Eisler ever ask you to join the Communist Party?
No.
Did Hans Eisler ever ask you to join the Communist Party?
No, he did not. I think they considered me just as a writer who wanted to write the truth as he saw it, but not as a political figure.
Do you recall anyone ever having asked you to join the Communist Party?
Some people might have suggested it to me, but then I pointed out that it was not my business.
Who were those people that asked you to join the Communist Party?
Oh, readers or...
Who?
Readers of my poems or people from the audiences. You mean there was never an official approach to me, to public demand?
But some people did ask you to join the Communist Party, didn't they?
In Germany? You mean in Germany?
No, I mean in the United States.
No.
Now, you let him. He's doing all right. He's doing much better than the other witnesses that you brought here. You don't ever recall anyone in the United States ever asked you to join the
no,
Communist
I
Party?
No, I do not recall anybody having asked
me. Mr. McDowell, do you have any questions?
No, I have
not. Mr. Vail? Mr. Stripling, do you have any more questions?
I would like to ask Mr. Breck whether or not he wrote a song, entitled Forward, We've Not Forgotten.
Forward, we've what?
Forward, We've Not Forgotten.
I do not recognize the English title, maybe. Can I see?
Would you translate it for him into German?
The literal translation of the German would read, Forward and Do Not Forget. It is a song well known to German left-wingers and generally called Solidaritätslied, Solidarity Song. The translation deviates from the German a good deal because the translator is hard up for rhymes and has to fit his words to Eisler's music. This translation, attributed to one Henry Jordan, was also put on a disc by Timely Recording Company in the 30s.
Oh, now I remember. Yes, I know.
You wrote
yes.
That. Are you familiar with words to that?
That is, yeah.
Would the committee like me to read that?
Yes, without objection, so it is.
Forward, we've not forgotten our strength in the fights we have won. No matter what may threaten, forward, not forgotten. How strong we are as one. Only these, our hands now aching, built the roads, the walls, the towers. All the world is of our making. What of it can we call ours? The refrain, forward, march on to power. Through the city, the land, the world. Forward, advance the hour. Just whose city is the city? Just whose world is the world? Forward, we've not forgotten. Our union in hunger and pain, no matter what may threaten, forward, not forgotten. We have a world to gain. We shall free the world of shadow. Every shop and every room, every road and every meadow, all the world will be our own. Did you write that, Mr. Breck?
No, I wrote a German poem, but that is very different, you see, from this thing.
That's all the questions I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Breck. And you're a good example to the witnesses of Mr. Kenny and Mr. Crump. We'll recess until 2 o'clock this afternoon.
At that, Bertolt Brecht left the room, and within a few hours he had left the United States forever. I personally was not present at this historic encounter, but it had been broadcast, and a year or so later, in his living room at Feldmeilen near Zurich, Brecht played me a recording of the broadcast which some friend had put on disc for him. I can still hear him laughing his dry laugh at the many comic turns in the dialogue. Some of Brecht's friends wished he had pleaded the Fifth Amendment, but he reiterated in private what he had said on the stand. As a visitor to America, he did not think he should claim the privileges of a citizen. He added that his chief legal adviser, Bartley Crum, advised him to state that he was a communist. Nothing can happen to you since you're not a citizen, and it was the German party you would have been a member of. But I wasn't a member, Brecht said, he protested. It makes no difference, Crum is supposed to have argued. If you say you weren't a member, they'll forge a party card and get you for perjury. Brecht told me he was unwilling to take this line and preferred to risk telling the truth. Possibly the aspersion allegedly cast by Crum on the honesty of the committee will seem unfair. On the other hand, the committee's chairman did go to jail in 1949, and the charge in essence was dishonesty. He had accepted kickbacks from employees. Even before the final exposure of Parnell Thomas as a fraud, Brecht was embarrassed by the compliment he had received from him. You are a good example to the witnesses of Mr. Kenny and Mr. Crum. But he gave Thomas and his colleagues credit for one thing. They weren't as bad as the Nazis, he said. The Nazis would never have let me smoke. In Washington, they let me have a cigar, and I used it to manufacture pauses with between their questions and my answers.
Welcome back. This is Symposium. We just heard the hearings of Bertolt Brecht before the House Un-American Activities Committee, held on October 30th, 1947. Between October 20th and October 30th, the HUAC investigated the so-called, quote-unquote, communist infiltration of the motion picture industry by interrogating 24 witnesses associated with Hollywood at that time. Five of them were considered friendly witnesses to the anti-communist cause. Ronald Reagan, Ayn Rand, Gary Cooper were amongst them, and 19 were considered unfriendly. From those scheduled to appear before the committee, 8 didn't show up, and 10 appeared but refused to answer the committee's questions, claiming that its activity was unconstitutional. They thenceforth became known as the Hollywood 10. Besides these 10 people, there was an 11th man who had been called to testify the last day of the hearings. The 11th man in the Hollywood 10 was Bertolt Brecht. Our hearings of the hearings, in two parts, included a one-month interlude, an interlude from which, by the way, I am writing and reading this. I sincerely hope that you, dear listener, survived the very dangerous month of September. For me, that's still the future. I am, so to speak, sending you an audio postcard from an airplane in between time zones. One side of the postcard is this text. The other shows Eric Bentley holding a portrait of Bertolt Brecht, the cover of his Folkways record. Bertolt Brecht wearing an unusual suit, a tie, his round glasses, and speaking in front of several microphones in some sort of card room. Brecht is facing the Un-American Activities Committee, which remains out of the picture. At times, Eric Bentley described the hearings in terms of a Brechtian tragicomedy, and other times, he described the event with a formula of his predilection, the biologist being taken as an object of study by apes, meaning that a very odd and clumsy form of theater was organized to host, or should I say to encircle, one of the foremost masters of the modern dramatic device, B.B., the 11th man. Many comparisons are plausible, but two come especially to mind. First, let's not forget that, while the gang of apes prepares the theater scene, the biologist is forced into it by means of a subpoena. The band of apes is eager, and the biologist reluctant to participate. The latter decides to play the game until he can take the first exit in a similar situation to the protagonist of Julio Cortázar's story, Instructions for John Howell. The character goes to the theater to see a play, and in the middle of it, he is taken backstage, given costumes and instructions, and thrown on stage to replace an actor. Then he understands other actors are also kidnapped members of the audience. I see in this a strong parable about the artist's political engagement, although I am pretty sure Brecht would disagree with my vision. Second comparison, the evolution of the hearings from tension and hostility on the part of the committee members and the audience to some sort of hysterical exhilaration and general fraud, cachondeo, makes me think of famous fictive or reconstructed trials where the search for judicial truth is ridiculed as a grotesque masquerade. Besides, of course, the fraudulent trial in Brecht's Mahogany, I remember the Stalinist trial in Costa Gavras's film, The Confession, which I believe is a pertinent comparison. One of the accused, as he stands up for public interrogation, loses control of his pants. They drop. There's confusion and exhilaration. The tribunal highly disapproves this accident and insults the witness. Laughter in trials is such a locus. It's one of the few moments when the audience participates in a manifest manner. What is the difference between the theater audience and the trial audience? The differences are dim, indeed. It wouldn't be illogical if one had to purchase a ticket to attend a trial, by the way. And this said, Brecht was lucky to perform in this un-American circus, despite the ruthless bureaucracy and the bad jokes and the absurd spectacle and all you want. He would not have been so lucky under a Stalinist regime, he who spent the last decade of his life wearing an appalling Stalinist disguise. Had Brecht been an American citizen, he would have been blacklisted. In other words, he would have had to work at a factory to support himself, for example. In other words, he would have lived to keep writing anyhow. Had the trial happened in some sinister basement of a government building in Moscow, we would not even have a transcript. It goes without saying that I admire Brecht, the skeptic, but I loathe his Stalinistic acquiescence and his inclination for propaganda. We may consider the latter a result of a historical entrapment, but that could never work as an alibi. Did Brecht refuse to see the bullet that went into Tretiakov's head, along with many other bullets, 10 years before his deposition in D.C. Would Tretiakov's trial be included in Brecht's utopian theater of justice? I don't even know if Tretiakov had a trial. In the end, the artist always seems to suffer the effects of politics on levels his or her work cannot reach, and propaganda is certainly the most unforgivable aesthetic mistake.
You people can watch while I'm scrubbing these floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking. Maybe once you tip me and it makes you feel swell in this crummy southern town and this crummy old hotel, but you'll never guess to who you're talking.
The hearings are interesting in their folds. If Bentley speaks about a Brechtian tragicomedy, the interrogator, Mr. Something, says it more clearly when he reads Tretiakov's article evoking Brecht's project in 1932 to organize a theater entirely devoted to reenact the most interesting trials in the history of mankind. The investigator seems unaware of the fact that he is contributing to the making of one of those trials and feeding Brecht's unrealized project with an incomparable material. He is putting Brecht on the scene of his own dreamed theater of justice. Bentley, on his side of things, will not be oblivious of this fascinating redundancy. His book, 30 Years of Treason, which compiles hundreds of transcripts of hearings before the HUAC, is an American script that could provide Brecht's trial theater with enough material for years of programming. The courtroom is the stage where the tension between the truth and the appearance of truth is more palpable, and often more crude. It is the space of proof and falsification, the dissection table of responsibility. Brecht knows this well and walks the way of non-truth that leads toward the airport. He knows questions too can be true or false. For Brecht, the interrogation is based on false grounds. For him, being or not a communist is not the point. Being an American is not the point, as he had already had the experience of being un-German and becoming a stateless writer. Besides, he knows he may be, at worst, deported as was his friend Hans Eisler. I suspect he would have been more ready to discuss why one is brought by circumstances to take one side or another. The interrogation mistakes the point, the committee refuses to hear his statement, and Brecht gives non-truth in return. Brecht's memory performs a form of dribbling dance as soon as a name is named. The name can be recalled, not the date, or vice versa, if the date is more relevant than the name, or vice versa. A face goes perfectly blur, just as the page of a newspaper read decades ago, like in a dream. Or only the trivial detail of a meeting is remembered. Sometimes, facts are drowned in generality. In that, too, Brecht's skill was quite remarkable. How can we be sure we went to that or that place, performance, reception, meeting? And if we really were there, who can assure it was not an accident? A conversation is turned inside out like a sock. And this notwithstanding, Brecht doesn't exactly lie. Are you certain about this and that? I think so. In my opinion, I am certain, for now. Call it a carefully measured excess of intellectual precaution. But when documentation offers no escape, then the mist of translation makes the searchers miss again their prey. To which extent is the writer to be blamed for the translations of his work, especially those that are made by bureaucrats? That is not an extent that can be measured. In the end, Brecht's memory refuses to be translated. Besides, the author is not responsible for the misreading of his work, even if misreading is favored and in some cases encouraged. Brecht knew his part so well that at some point the committee members seemed to forget theirs, out of sheer frustration or even unwilling amusement. Brecht is not a sphinx like he is in his writings. He is rather one of those characters in Chuang Tzu's allegories, Mr. Elusiveness, handling the questions of Mr. Something. But now, I would like to highlight another aspect of the recording, no less elusive. Listen to this. Can you hear the ice cubes?
We are repeating the conversation. The young comrade. I am the secretary of the party headquarters, which is the last towards the border. My heart is beating for the revolution. The witnessing of wrongdoing drove me into the lines of the fighters. Man must help man. I am for freedom. I believe in mankind, and I am for the rules of the Communist Party, which fights for the classless society against exploitation and ignorance. The two of us have to defend the revolution here. Surely you have a letter to us from the Central Committee which tells us what to do. Rules of the Communist Party, which fights for the classless society against exploitation and ignorance.
Can you hear the ice cubes?
The two of us have this party, which fights for the classless society and the Communist Party, which fights for the classless society and the Communist Party, which fights for the classless society and the Communist Party, which fights for the classless society and...
Water, or is it scotch, ice cubes, hands manipulating something blindly before the microphone? I mean, before the blind microphone. The listener must take the standpoint of the recording device. I can't help being caught in the illusion that the recorder is on the other side, in the hearings room, inside the radio set that is being recorded. But no, it's actually encircling it, as Bentley is encircling it, as we are encircling the recording now, as I am myself encircled in the recording that is closest to the time surface. Where is the hearing room? Where is the hand? Background noises merge. If we believe what Bentley and the records booklet and other books tell us, if we believe these hearings were recorded from a radio set while broadcast live, then we have to cope with a few other assertions. The microphone, through which we hear the voices of the witness and the committee members, and the recording device that is preserving that event for us, the future, exist in two different dimensions, and the distance between them is insurmountable. There are microphones everywhere in the hearing room, and only one recording device in the radio room of 1947. And then there is Bentley behind a glass in the spring of 1963, and us in 2013, and so on. And thereby we can presume the differences between the noises of the record, the various layers of recording, and the marginal noises of the actual recorded scene, and the artificial and non-artificial background noises I have added. But where is the water? Where is the hand dropping ice into a glass? These noises are like moldings on a wall, delimiting the recording and holding the imprint of its present times, parentheses around the S. The historical truth of the recording is encrypted in its cracks and hiss, its noise, or what Adorno seemed to call the hear stripe, whose texture collates with that of time itself. Like a chorus, the various layers of background noise perform a dialogue between the historical elements of the recording, some of them fictive, perhaps, the situation contained in it and its oral surfaces. The needle plows through the years. The record itself is but a plow, making a tight spiral. Now, if you cut through the spiral and look at its section, what you will see is the concentric rings of time within the recording, like concentric years on the section of a sequoia trunk. The trunk is covered with historical dates, and you, dear listener, are at that point outside of the sequoia trunk.